to Black Belt Sewing with Stephanie and Anna Scheller. I'm Anna.
And I'm Stephanie.
We are a mother-daughter team who are passionate about helping you break through those obstacles that are keeping you from making more sales in your business. You can learn more about us by going to our Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/ Black Belt Selling. We love to have your input. Most importantly, though, you'll know when these broadcasts go live so that you can hear the amazing guests that we get as well as the content that we bring. And so go to facebook.com/groups/ Black Belt Selling. Ask to join. We'd love to have you in our group. Now, Stephanie, I am continuing to be amazed at how I find these guests that you go, who? And our guest this week was one of those.
Well, you have to elaborate. It's where I go, who? Yeah, I don't know who that person is. And then, like, you know, the next week and the week after and the week after and the week after, someone comes to me and is like, do you know who this person is? And I'm like, no, but I'm about to interview them, so I guess I should find out who. It's like this person just like suddenly appears in my life and all of a sudden I realize they're this big name. It's quite ironic. Humorous, funny. I don't know what to say there.
Well, I don't know, but we are going to get an opportunity to meet with him now, so we're pretty excited. I've gotten to know Jeb Blunt through his friends, particularly Mark the Sales Hunter, who has become a friend of mine and has been a frequent guest on Black Belt Selling. But let me share with you a little bit about this amazing guy. Jeb is a sales acceleration specialist, and he's authored over 10 books, including Fanatical Prospecting, another great book for prospecting, Sales EQ, People Buy You, People Follow You, and his most recent book, Objections. He is among the world's most respected thought leaders on prospecting, sales, leadership, and customer experience. Through his global training organization, Sales Gravy, Jeb advises a who's who of the world's leading organizations and their executives on the impact of emotional intelligence and interpersonal skills on customer-facing activities. And let me tell you guys, Jeb was quite the interesting person to have. We're just real thrilled that Jeb was able to join us because, as you heard, guys travels all over the world. So he's quite a phenomenon. He was very, very fun to be with, very personable. So we really want you to listen because the primary focus of our talk today was
objection handling.
Objection handling. So if you're curious, this is the book, Objections by Jeb Blunt. I think it's on Audible. I know it's on Kindle.
I have to add this real quick. I mean, I interact with a lot of people and I get people who show up on my radar sometimes that show up again and again. And then I finally check them out and I'm kind of like, there's a reason I didn't know who they were. And Jeb was not one of them. Like, he showed up when I finally started, I started going through one of his books, listening to him talk. I just sat there and I was like, wow, I'm pretty good at sales. This guy's a genius. Like, I was really, really impressed listening to him and meeting him. And I think our listeners are going to love this interview.
I think so. So go ahead and listen. We'll be talking with you at the end. Well, Jeb, we are so excited that you've taken time out from your extremely busy schedule to join us on Black Belt Selling. Thank you for coming today.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you guys for being so persistent and trying to get me on the show. And I'm truly grateful for you for, you know, having me on so we can talk about my brand new book, Objections. This is awesome.
This is exciting. So I am curious, Jeb. I know Anna has been reading through the book and sharing all the juiciest tidbits with me, which makes me want to go read through the book myself here. There's so many books out there about objection handling, right? What made you say, oh, we need to do another one about objection handling when there's so many options for people?
Well, you know, the truth is there's really not that many books out there on objections. There's a lot of books out there on scripts, books that say, you know, if buyer says this, then you say this, or if that happens, then you do this. Those books are out there, but there's really not the psychology of all of that, you know, that that emotional stew, and then providing frameworks that are usable no matter what context you're in for dealing with objections. And when I decided to write this book, what I noticed was that in most sales training, in most sales books, there is almost always something written about objections, almost always. But it's usually something that's small and it's at the back. Like if you go to most sales training programs, like you do the whole sales training and then you're like 3 hours before the end of the training and everybody's worn out and then you try to deal with objections. So it's not really the star of the show, right? It's something else. And the other books that are out there, a lot of the books are really, really dated. And what I found is that a lot of it's just cheesy, old school, and I hate using the word old school, but stuff from the last century that never worked anyway, but sounded really good. So the much more manipulative, these little tie down mechanisms, yeah, things like that, versus really dealing with the way modern buyers go to market and the way great salespeople have always dealt with objections. So I hate to use the word old school, but this isn't new for people who are really good at the craft. And that's why, I looked at this and said, I'm switching and I'm going to write this book. I switched off another book that I was writing on negotiation to move this book up in the lineup, as you might say.
Negotiation. Okay. That's the next book I need to make sure gets in my library.
Yeah. That book is called Inked. So it'll be out in next year, about the same time objections came out, next year around May.
Nice. Cool. And I like that you mentioned, you commented on the fact that there's a lot of concepts out there in sales that never really worked. Old school, but never actually really worked. Sounded good, because there's still people out there trying to do that. And I think that's where we've got this sleazy, slimy, arm twisting objection or salesman model from, that is just such a big turnoff to so many people.
Well, you're exactly right. The one thing that I've always, said to people is there's really no old school or new school. There's the school when it comes to sales. And the school is, how do you deal with other human beings? And the way that humans deal with other humans, the art of the relationship and the way the human brain works has been baked into us for 40,000 years when the modern brain emerged in human beings. And the way we deal with each other has not changed because we've gotten smarter or better or what have you. And great salespeople, whether you were selling in 1920 or you're selling in 2020, they've always practiced the craft of selling in a very consistent manner. It's people who don't really know how to sell, or who are afraid of sales, or think that they have some magic pill that's going to change everything, that end up creating some of these sort of sycophantic, type objection handling moves that just don't work. I mean, I remember being taught the Ben Franklin close when I was starting out in sales. So my early 20s, somebody taught me the Ben Franklin close, and I tried it, a couple of times, and it was so stupid. It didn't work. Like, it didn't work. But talking to an adult human being, Ben Franklin close, they knew exactly what you were doing, and it just made you look stupid. And I learned very quickly not to employ tactics like that, and instead focus on how do I influence the behavior that the human being, focus on what they're afraid of and what the issues are that are holding them. Remember that I'm doing my job all the way through the sales process, because that's really where objection handling begins, is if you follow the process all the way through, you're going to hit some along the way, but you're going to be so much better with those objections when you have, you have done a good job of discovery, you've asked questions, you've built relationships, you're dealing with a qualified buyer, you really understand what's important to them. That's when this gets easier and it gets, the frameworks work. If you haven't done all of that, if you just showed up and throwed up, just did that, all you're dealing with is price and you have no ammunition either for dealing with objections or dealing with negotiation.
One of the things that I think, I love how you're talking about that, it's, we get Ben Gay the Third. I'm sure you're familiar with Ben, contemporary of Zig Ziglar, so on and so forth. And, we ask him occasionally, so what's different? And he goes, really? Nothing. I haven't changed the way I sell over all of these years that I've been selling. I mean, he's been around for a very long time. And so we go, it's true. Good. You talk about the craft of sales. I love that, because it's an art as well as a science. It's a way of relating to people and bringing value to them. And I know that's becoming cliche, but it really is true. Are you there for them? Or are you there for yourself? Now, one of the things that you talk a lot about, especially in the beginning of the book, is what you call the discipline of the ask. Why do you call it a discipline?
Well, it's the most important discipline in sales is asking. And Jim Rohn once said that asking is the beginning of receiving, right? So, and he's exactly right about that. You have to ask to get. And the problem for salespeople in most cases is they're beating around the bush of asking. It happens all the time. I had a young sales guy that I was working with who had called me about some software that we were interested in looking at. And this kid, and I call him a kid because he was a kid, this kid just couldn't confidently ask for anything. And he was waiting for us to do the job for him. And the only way that you're going to get what you want is to ask for what you want. That is a fact that won't change. And asking is a pretty simple thing. You ask with confidence. You shut up and you just allow the other person to answer you. And most salespeople, they don't ask with confidence. When they do ask, they keep talking and they end up talking themselves right out of whatever they want. And we're asking for all kinds of things. I mean, we always think about we're asking for the sale, and of course we are, but we're asking for micro commitments along the way. We're asking for appointments. We're asking for information. We're asking to level up to a decision maker. We're asking all the time. And because emotions are contagious, it's called emotional contagion, because human beings can feel and sense what other human beings are feeling, we have the ability to transfer our emotions to another person. You mentioned Zig Ziglar. Zig was talking about this in the 1970s. And today, neuroscientists have shown us exactly how this works. So this is the science of selling. Zig knew this, and Dale Carnegie knew this. I mean, the guys way back in the 20s knew this. They all had this information. But over the last 30 years or so, neuroscientists have been able to show us that emotions are contagious. So the most powerful position for a salesperson is the position of relaxed confidence. And when you ask with confidence, you can change everything. And to tell you how powerful this is, we were with a group of inside salespeople a few weeks back. We did 1 hour worth of training on just how to ask. We didn't teach them anything else, no objection handling, no asking questions, no anything. How to ask with confidence. We spent an hour with them, put them back on the telephone. We got a 600% increase in sales in the next hour over their run rate just by teaching them how to ask with confidence.
Holy crap, 600. That's huge. So I was just talking with a team yesterday about how focusing on just one thing at a time can make such a massive difference. That's such a perfect exemplification of that. That's incredible. That's, wow, holy crap. I know you also talk, I know, sorry. You also talk about horses and how working with horses are like working with, I have to ask this question because I'm a horse chick. So what's this whole horse thing? And horses are like stakeholders and you know, let's dig in here.
Well, I grew up around horses, and I live on a farm. I drove down my driveway this morning on the way to the office and, you know, stopped and patted them on their, you know, on their heads. And I love horses. And horses are one of the most amazing analogies for human beings, because if you think about it as a rider, the horse has the ability to be completely in control. The horse is about 10 times bigger than you are. The horse can run faster, move faster, kick you, do all kinds of things. So the only way that you're able to influence a horse's behavior is the horse believes that you have the confidence to make the horse do what they're going to do. And what I've noticed my entire life is you get someone who's unsure, and I'm sure that as a horse chick, right? As sure as a horse chick, you've seen this happen too. You get somebody, they're a little bit trepidatious, they're a little bit, you know, insecure about it, they're a little bit fearful. They transfer that emotion to the horse, and the horse says, "Ha, you're insecure. I'm gonna run away with you." Even the best horse, like the best horse ever, will take advantage of a rider who doesn't feel confident. But on the flip side of that, I've been around horses my entire life. I'm not afraid of any of them. There's not a horse out there that scares me. I've been on horses that are not broke, horses that fear, horses that fuck, horses, everything. And it's amazing. I can walk up to a horse, put my hands on its muzzle, have a little kind of conversation with it, get on its back. And in 10 minutes, people are going, "Wow, how do you do that?" And I'm not a horse whisperer. I'm just not afraid of the horse. And as soon as the horse gets that, as soon as they understand that, then I get in control. The same thing happens in sales with people. People are incredibly predictable. If you were weak, if you were insecure, if you were self-conscious, If you lack self-esteem and you show up, people will run right over you just like a horse will. They'll do exactly the same thing, going back to the discipline to ask, going back to dealing with objections, and every objection turn around. You've got to be confident. We begin with that process. Now, we know that, for example, salespeople deal with a lot of emotions. Our disruptive emotions in sales are the things that hold us back more than anything else out there. Right. So part of what objections does is it shows you why you feel the way you do. Why do you lack the confidence? Why do you feel insecure or fearful? Why does that happen? And that's not, you know, doing that you know, tried and true, you know, trope in sales where we just tell people to let it roll off their back. It's explaining to people that the way you feel when you're asking or you're facing an objection is real. And those emotions do happen to you. And if you want to get control over it, you have to have a ledge, or you have to become rejection proof so that you can handle that. Go back to the horse analogy. Why is it that some people stand in front of this horse really, really big and their heart's beating really fast and they're afraid? And you and me, we get in front of a horse and it just feels normal.
Right.
Well, part of that is obstacle immunity, right? We've experienced it so much. I don't remember not being on a horse. I've been on a horse since I was a child. And I know exactly what to do. And by the way, I have a mechanism for managing my own fear when I'm on a horse, because I do get afraid sometimes, especially when I'm, you know, running across a pasture or through the woods, or a horse starts acting up in the wrong place. There are points when I do get afraid, but I've developed systems to manage that fear so that the horse never knows what my emotion is. And the same thing for salespeople. We teach you frameworks so that you can manage your fear, a system for doing that, so that the prospect never knows what's actually happening below the surface.
You know, it's really interesting because in reading the book, we put out a poll because we wanted to know what people wanted to really hear about. So I want to get to the rejection proof here in a little bit. But one of the things that I find that, especially because I deal a lot with coaches, I deal a lot with people who are in the self-help industry, and many of them want to not appear pushy. I mean, that's how they come. They call me first. I don't want to be salesy. I don't want to be pushy. And in effect, what they do is they kind of back away. They skirt around it, thinking that maybe it's going to get them more of what they're looking for. But based on what you're saying, that's not really true, is it?
No, there's a real paradox with confidence, and that is that when you feel confident, when you ask, for example, and typically when we're saying we don't want to be too pushy, it's at that inflection of asking for something, right? We're asking for someone to comply with the request. We're asking for them to do business with us, whatever it is. And people say, I don't want to be too pushy. But the paradox of that is when you try not to be pushy, you create more resistance, because that's how human beings and horses work. When you show insecurity, people push back, they become more resistant. When you are confident, now I'm not talking about arrogant, right? And I'm not talking about when people say salesy, what they see in their head is something they saw in a movie, which is a salesperson talking and talking. Talking is not asking. Asking is, how about we do this, right? So that's asking. So when people say that, you know, as a coach, I work with them and I'll say, okay, we're going to ask again, ask again, ask again, ask again, until I teach them what to do. Mm-hmm. But see, the problem when you're asking is that as soon as you ask, you feel vulnerable. Because as soon as you ask, there's a potential that you're going to get rejected. So what happens is you start anticipating what might happen when you ask before you ask. That creates worry, that triggers fight or flight, that triggers the disruptive emotions that get in your way. And then you go, would it kind of be okay if maybe it would be all right? You know, kind of maybe if we could like go to the next step, would that be okay with you? And then, and you get a 2x4 to the forehead for doing that, and you don't understand. And then you go, well, this doesn't even work either. You know, so the key is what you say, how you say it. The key is your tone of voice, your body language. When you ask with confidence. So a lot of people say these days, I notice a lot of young people use the words, I just wanted to. I just wanted to is as passive and weak of words as you can get. Just is protecting yourself from rejection, and wanted to was yesterday. So it's teaching, you know, people to say, I want. This is what I want. This is what I want you to do. This is what I'm asking you to do. And when you do that, my story earlier about the increase in sales from just learning how to ask in a different way, the results are incredible. But when you ask that way, the people, especially the people that don't want to be too pushy, like everything inside of their brain is going, run, because they feel like they're about to get, you know, rejected. And that's why you've got to have mechanisms and at least awareness of what's going on inside of you so that you can ask with confidence. And I just, you know, I can't say this enough. Emotions are contagious. When you transfer relaxed confidence to your buyer, the probability that they're going to comply with your request goes up exponentially.
First of all, I love how you brought it to emotions, and I love how you've made sales about horses. I'm totally digging this whole conversation. My brain's going wild with, I'm connecting so many dots. But I am curious. I know you talk about four different types of objections. So unfortunately, I'm going to move away from horses for a minute here, just because I'm curious to hear what are these four different types of objections? Can you maybe dig into that?
Yes. So when you take a look at like any books on rejection or articles on rejection, what you typically find is how to deal with the price objection, how to get, you know, deal with I'm not interested objection, or, you know, all of these different things. When we talk about the four types of objections, what we're talking about is throughout the sales process, from prospecting all the way to closing, there are objections that you run into. And some of them are objections you run into. Some of them are really tough objections, like prospecting objections. Some of them are really benign, like asking for the next step, getting to the next micro commitment. So what we have to do when we think about objections, is we have to break it apart into where the objection happens in the sales process. That begins with prospecting. So prospecting objections are your number one objections, or the objections that are going to be the most harsh, and the objections that are going to be much more like rejection. And prospecting essentially is asking for time, and time is the hardest ask in sales because nobody has any. Then you have micro commitment. You know, these are objections that are getting you to the next step. So we have a conversation with you and, you know, let's say you're a small business and I'm selling you a marketing automation software program. My next step is we want to talk to the CEO. That might be a next step, or the next step might be to do a proposal. So I'm asking for those. The next type of objection is a red herring objection. Now, red herring objections are not real objections. They're kind of like false objections, but these are objections that you get when at the very beginning of a call or within a group of people, where they say, well, you know, we saw a review of you online and it wasn't very good. And what salespeople have a tendency to do is they chase these red herrings that have no impact on the sales versus staying in the process, remaining in control. And finally, the objections when you ask someone to do business with you, sign a contract, or what have you, run into those. Now, there's different flavors and categories, give you, you know, core frameworks. So when you face that objection, how to get control of your emotion, how to disrupt the prospect's pattern of dealing with those type of objections and responses, and then how to ask again for what you want.
So is that the objection handling process? So get control of your emotions, disrupt the pattern, and then ask again?
Well, there's a different framework for each one, but you basically nailed it. So if you think about it, you know, the process is we call it a ledge. So what a ledge is that as soon as you face an objection, your brain starts responding to that. You have a little piece of your brain right in the limbic system. The limbic system is the emotional part of your brain, and it's called the amygdala. And the amygdala is the emotional hub of the brain. So if you read anything on emotional intelligence, you'll learn a lot about the amygdala. But the amygdala's job essentially is to scan the environment, looking for danger, looking for anomalies, patterns, things like that. And the amygdala decides where information goes. Do we send it up to the neocortex, which is the part of our brain that makes us human, and think it's that gray matter you see when you see a picture of the brain, or send it down through the cerebellum, which is your autonomic brain. Some people call it the reptilian brain or croc brain, but it's simply the brain. If you're breathing right now, the cerebellum is running a lot of processes that happen in your body that you don't have to think about. So when the amygdala senses a danger, a threat, it responds by triggering something called the fight or flight response. And we've all experienced this. You've been in a situation, let's say that you're about to get on a horse and your heart's beating, right? You feel fight or flight, right? And a lot of people want to run, right? And then some people, you know, if the horse starts acting up, they get mad at it. And you've seen people who lose their temper with a horse and they start fighting a horse. And I hang out with thoroughbreds, and I can tell you straight up, you start fighting thoroughbred, you might win the battle, but you're by God going to lose the war. So you have to control your emotions the entire time, right? So the idea is that we create a mechanism called a ledge so that when we start feeling a threat, and one of those threats is a social threat, in other words, someone ostracizing you, kicking you out, banishing you or what have you. So what we're able to do is we're able to, at this point, use this ledge to get control of our brain function, put our neocortex back in executive control. Then we have a response that disrupts the pattern that the prospect or the customer is expecting. So as human beings, we deal with other human beings a lot. So we know exactly what other human beings are gonna do. So we use non-complementary behavior to disrupt the pattern, which gets their attention. It hits their amygdala and says, oh, this is new and different, pulls them towards us, and then we ask again. Now, with buying commitment objections, it's much deeper than that, because when you're asking someone to make a commitment to give you money, sometimes there are multiple layers of objection. So we have to isolate those and clarify exactly what we're dealing with. And we want to minimize their fear of moving forward, not argue them against that. And a prospecting objection is really, really quick, right? We just ledge, disrupt, and ask. And in a micro commitment objection, what we're trying to do there is just show them the value of moving to the next step. Because most of the time, they'll give you additional time if you just show them why it's worth their time and effort to do that.
Nice. Anna, did you have a question on that one? I know this was an area you were super excited about.
I am. You know, it is. Because one of the things is people like to have a one-size-fits-all kind of deal. You know, just give me, and you mention it quite a bit in the book, which, by the way, if you're watching, listening to this broadcast, you really need to get the book, because we are just touching the very tip of the iceberg. I mean, there's just so much depth. There's so much more in the book. Like, Deb, you were just talking about ways to rejection-proof yourself. Maybe you could go a little bit more into that. We only have a few more minutes left, but I think that's important. Our listeners were asking, how do I get rejection proof? So they're looking for the magic bullet. So is it here? Can we give it to them?
Well, there's not necessarily a magic bullet. I think the rejection proof begins on understanding where rejection comes from, or your fear of rejection comes from. And it's baked into our DNA. It's much more biological than psychological. And that's one of the problems that you find in sales training rooms across the world, is that sales trainers and authors and experts and a lot of managers treat the fear of rejection like it's a psychological disorder. And it's not. It's a biological response that we evolved into. And it goes back to, say, 40,000 years or so, when the modern human brain developed. We lived in small groups of humans who lived in caves and in tents and teepees, and it was a pretty tough world. There were things out there that would eat you. There were warring tribes that wanted to take your resources. We typically lived in really small groups of people. We relied on each other to hunt and gather because there wasn't a grocery store down the street or an Uber app to pick you up. And people's life was pretty short. And the problem back then is that if you lived in a small group of people and you got sideways with the people in your group, if you got rejected, that meant you got kicked out of the cave. If you got kicked out of the cave, it was a death sentence because you couldn't survive without those people. So human beings that developed a sensitivity to being rejected for not being pushy were people who had a tendency to pass on their DNA. So rejection proof begins with that awareness. It's who you are. And by the way, rejection is not, the fear of rejection is not always a bad thing. It teaches you where the limits are in your relationships. It teaches you how to deal with other people. It gives you information about what's happening there. So it tells you when not to push, but the not being too pushy is part of our mechanism to try to stay in the cave and stay with people. The problem for salespeople is that your job is to go out and seek out rejection. So if your job is to seek out rejection, or if you're an entrepreneur, your job is to go seek out more customers, right? Or get more money or whatever you have to do, then learn how to deal with that. So we go back to rejection proof. There's a lot of ways that you can, you can become rejection proof. One way is creating mechanisms like the ledge. All the ledge is when someone hits me with an objection, I know exactly what to do. I know exactly what to say, exactly what to ask. It's rote. I don't have to think about it. I interrupt the processes that run through my body. You also want to be able to build the fortitude or the ability to rise above the emotion. So fight or flight happens without your consent. When I'm, for example, with a horse and that horse is acting up, I feel fear. It's not a situation where I don't feel fear. I'm not an emotionless person. But I feel the fear, and then I'm able to rise above that and choose my response. And that's all. That's how rejection proof works, right? You choose your response, and this is how you develop what they call obstacle immunity. And that means that you face it and face it and face it and face it. Now, sometimes people need coaches like you guys to help them and help people work through that process. But mostly it's put yourself in a situation where you have to be rejected, where you have to ask. Do that over and over and over again. Practice and practice and practice so that you begin to learn that when people tell you no, it's not going to get you kicked out of the cave. And your brain begins to deal with it. So it sees the obstacle. It knows that it's there. It still feels the emotion. But you have the ability to rise above the emotion and choose your response. Mm-hmm. And we give you several steps that you can roll through, but it's not a, like, you're not going to feel rejection or you're not going to feel the emotion. That's what people want. People want to be zombies so they don't feel anything. Right. And it doesn't work that way. It's about being able to have the ability to choose how you respond in situations where your emotions are rolling over you and running.
And I think that, using the horse analogy, it's kind of like when you do get thrown from a horse, right? So you basically said, go get thrown from a horse 100 times. We've always joked, I don't know if you guys ever joked about that. We always joked you weren't a real rider until you'd been thrown at least once, right?
No, that's when I remember as a kid, I remember falling off a horse, and I remember this, crying and, all upset, and your feelings are hurt. Your feelings are hurt way more than your body's hurt.
Usually, and as a kid.
I remember my mom, an incredible horsewoman. I remember her, picking me up and making me get back on the horse. And I remember going, no, I don't want to get back on the horse. I don't want to get back on the horse. As you're getting back on the horse and you get back on the horse, that's how you develop obstacle immunity. You fall off, you get back on, your brain goes, oh, I'm okay. And then you do it again, you do it again, you do it again. Because if you don't do that, right, you won. That's exactly what you're saying. If you haven't fallen off a bunch of times, you don't know how to ride a horse.
The first time I really got to ride a horse, he ran away with me. They turned on the lights in the arena and a spark flew out, hit him in the butt, and he ran away. And I wanted to get, I didn't fall off, but I wanted off. I was like, as soon as they got him to stop, I was like, I am getting off this horse. I'm done. And no one would let me off the freaking horse.
It was hilarious too. It was fun to see that horse. Horse knew what to do, man. He hit those barrels. She came in second place, even though she'd only been riding 6 months, because she didn't know what she was doing, but the horse did. That's one where the horse was in control. Anyway, we're moving away from this.
The point was, you're facing the fear, right? Yeah. Do what Jeb's saying anyhow. So before we start pulling out all the Stephanie yarns from the closet, Jeb, I know we're pretty much out of time here. We always love to ask this question, especially when we get someone like you who's seen a couple of things. What is the absolute, I know you get asked, what's the best piece of advice you've ever heard? I don't care about that. You get asked that all the time. What is the absolute worst piece of advice you have ever heard someone give when it comes to sales?
Oh my, that is a hard question. I've heard so much bad advice. the worst advice that I've heard, and it's really just recently, in fact, I saw it as early this morning, was don't call people anymore. Wait for them to call you. Buyers don't want to be interrupted. So you have to sit around and wait for them to call you up. And I hear this over and over and over again. And it's typically from pseudo experts and gurus who have this belief system that's a little bit skewed, and it's skewed because they can't do it. They're afraid of rejection themselves. So they give people advice about not doing outbound prospecting, not doing the work to fill up the pipeline, because they're too afraid to do it on their own, and they don't have the mechanisms in place to do that. So, their idea is to tell people that doesn't work anymore. It's horrible, horrible advice. Doing outbound prospecting, reaching out and filling up your pipeline, doing the work to connect with other human beings and pull them into the pipeline. However you're doing that, warm, cold, hot, I don't care what it is, getting referrals, there's nothing that replaces that for sales for small businesses, because the pipe is life. And if you do that, you have to face a lot of rejection and objection in order to get to that place. And that advice, when people tell you not to do that, the world doesn't work that way anymore, people don't answer the phone, all of this crap that is just crap. All of that advice is horrible, and if you're a smart person, you don't pay attention to it, and most smart people aren't paying attention to it. It's just noise.
It is, but it is still out there. And you're right, it's out there, and you hear it from a different guru every day that you don't have to call anymore. If you're smart enough with your marketing, people will call you. And I'm like, that's not how that works. Thanks. Nice try.
It doesn't work. And if you, and I have a lot of my clients, you know, have brilliant marketing machines. They're just bringing in leads. They're fantastic. And what's interesting is that we get hired by CMOs more than we get hired by CSOs, because the CMOs recognize that they cannot even, there will never be enough money and never be enough resources to provide all the leads that a sales organization needs. And so they bring us in most often to work with the sales team, to teach the sales team how to do outbound prospecting, because they realize that they're not going to be able to support the organization's growth. And we're on three projects like that right now, where we're working in conjunction with marketing to help sales organizations do a better job of outbound prospecting. So you're right. There's a guru on every corner that tells you that you don't have to do this, or you don't have to do that, or this is dead, or that is dead. Nothing's dead. I will go back to what, you know, Ben Gay III said. I've been doing this the same way for 30 years, and the best salespeople have always succeeded because they follow core principles in sales that work, and they will continue to work, and they will always work.
And I think that is a perfect note to end on. Jeff, this was freaking amazing. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you. Freaking amazing. I love that. That's awesome.
You know, Stephanie, Jeb was even better in person than I imagined he would be. But I really, really enjoyed our conversation about objections, because so many of us, we go onto the ledge like he talked about it. It's kind of like when somebody says, well, I don't know, we immediately get these fearful emotions, these, you know, like, oh no, we're losing the sale. And he had some really good things to say about coming off the ledge, because we have to realize that not only are we on the ledge, our buyers on the ledge, they're making a big decision. And we have to be respectful of that without losing control of the conversation.
Yeah, you do. And I think a big part of it is remembering, you know, hey, you're not on the ledge alone. Don't panic, right? You're right up there with your buyer. Yep. And the moment you panic, right, you know, going back to his whole conversation about horses, which I'm still like over the moon excited about, that he talked about sales and horses. It was like the best conversation ever. But so I love, he spoke about, right, how the buyer mimics what you give out. And the moment you panic, so does your buyer. And if your buyer's on the ledge with you, and you're it's like lemmings going over the edge, just it's all done. It's all done.
Well, it is. And you know, the horse analogy was a really important one. Jeb is from the South, and he grew up with horses. Of course, I had read that in the book, because I read the book.
I read the other book.
So she read the other book. Fine. But anyway, the whole idea about horses, there's so many analogies in nature that we can look at to really help us get a picture of what's happening. So you're a horsewoman. Explain a little bit about what Jeb was talking about in the horse analogy we mentioned.
Well, I love, there was one thing that I don't think we really dove into as deep. It was very cool, right? Because knowing horses, and hopefully anyone out there who does know horses and sales can kind of start to see all these analogies, because when you're working with horses, there's so many layers going on there, right? And it's truly special. But I did want to kind of delve into something a little bit. You kind of mentioned, right? So we talk about horses, and horses have a herd leader, right? So horses have herd mentality, and they operate as a herd, and they run as a herd, they flee as a herd, they live as a herd, they're happy as a, you know, right? You take my horse away from his friends and he starts panicking. But there's the herd leader, right? And the herd leader steps into that position by being the most confident, the most dominant, right? Horses don't want to get hurt. So oftentimes all it takes to become the leader is for them, the horse, to be super confident, right? There would be a fight sometimes, but that's besides the point. Once you have the leader, so don't fight with your prospects. Once you have the leader, right, the whole herd looks to them and listens to them for their cues. And this goes to what we just talked about with the ledge, right? If I'm following you, right, if you're selling me and you're uncomfortable, either you don't understand how something's going to work, or maybe you aren't comfortable with the price point, or maybe you don't believe in what you're selling, I'm looking to you for cues. And I think it's still 80-some-odd percent of our communication is nonverbal, right?
Absolutely. It's phenomenal.
At least 60. A ton of our communication is nonverbal. If I'm watching you for nonverbal cues and you're getting nervous or anxious, I'm picking up on that. In the sales situation, you are the leader. You should be more knowledgeable than your prospect. If you're not, you should work on that. Just saying.
Well, and one of the things that happens a lot in sales, and I am learning to overcome this myself, but I thought that by doing this one thing, I was actually being a really good salesperson. But by doing this one thing, especially when it was time to ask for the order, Stephanie, I was actually conveying to the prospect, well, I'm not sure that this is really going to work. And that is when we present the idea of what we want to, when we present the idea, or we ask, we make the ask, and then we say, well, you know what, if you want to, or we think we're being nice, what we're really doing is we're being soft and we're being unassertive. We're not being confident. And the buyer wants to know that if they're going to give you their money, you know how to handle their money and you know how to deliver the product. So instead of being afraid to ask for the money, we need to be assertive, not a bowling ball kind of thing, but we have to be confident in what we're asking, and we have to let them know how they're going to enjoy the product or service that we're offering them. It has to be very clear. If we're not clear, they're not going to be clear, and they're not going to move forward.
Well, and I think this goes back to the bit about, right, so your confidence, whoever's more confident is going to determine who's in charge of that conversation. So if I come to you and I'm like, well, if you're ready to buy, whenever you're ready to buy, then I'm coming across as lacking confidence, right? Like if I truly believe this is the right option for you, I'm like, hey, Anna, so we need to get this going. Like, let's go. Come on. I know this is going to make a big difference for you. And I'm super excited and super energetic as opposed to, so do you want to do this?
Yeah.
And so when I come across as that lack of confidence, what happens, it's kind of like, you know, if for those of you guys who watched my TED talk, when I talked about thunder rearing up at me in the round pen, trying to take the leadership position back. And the reason that animals do this is because when they sense that lack of authority, the problem is out in the wild with horses, you, if you're the leader and you're sitting there and you're like, do we run? I think we run. No, maybe, well, I don't know if we should run or not. Like, three members of your herd have already been slaughtered at this point.
Yeah.
And so your leader needs to be like, danger, run. And so we're looking for someone to be in that position, confident in what they're telling everyone else to do. And if you're not confident, if that leader's sitting there going, well, I don't know if we should run or not, someone else, another horse is going to step up and be like, all right, back off, baby doll. I got this. And they will take over that leadership position, which is exactly what happens inside the sales situation.
Exactly. Now, that doesn't mean that you have to be pushy or domineering in the conversation.
No, yeah.
No, as a matter of fact, if you've spent the time to get to know your prospect, if you've built the rapport, if you understand your prospect's needs, and you are confident that you can solve their problem, then you have the obligation to be assertive. You have the obligation to present it with confidence. And Jeb talked about that. And, you know, Jeb does not appear to me as the kind of guy that's going to sit there and stomp on your desk and make you do what he wants. He's been in sales a long time. I've also read his book, Fanatical Prospecting. And you know what? There was a time when Jeb hated prospecting. He was doing so poorly in prospecting, and he was in a bad mood, and his sales leader came to him and said, what's the problem? And he said, well, I haven't made any sales. And he goes, you know what your problem is? And he laid out the problem, and it was Jeb's own doing. And Jeb's been there. I mean, just because he's confident and he understands this stuff, he understands it because he's been there. He knows what it's like to pick up the phone with sweaty palms. He knows what it's like to go days on end without a sale. He knows that. And he wants, and all sales masters, all the people who become black belts, we don't all start out with, you know, a track record. Because
this is where that difference between confidence and pushy comes from, right? The more you do it, the more confident you're going to become. But if you don't get out there and do it, you're never, it's like going to the gym. The first time you go to the gym, you are sore as all get out the next day.
Yeah.
So the next time you go to the gym, you're not as sore. The more you do it, the easier it gets, the less painful it gets. And you build that level of confidence to where people will trust you and you don't have to be pushy about it. Confidence runs, I think confidence runs deeper than aggressiveness, right? Confident. If I'm confident, I'm confident in my core. Like, this is who I am. And if you don't like it, there's the door. And I'm cool with that. And then there's like pushy. That's like, this is who I am. And you know what, if you don't like it,
right? And pushy is needy. Pushy is desperate. Pushy is, and it's repelling. I just recently did a webinar on how to attract the right buyer. And when we're pushy, when we're desperate, we're attracting nothing except desperate people ourselves. And they're usually the ones that won't pay for what we do and what we can do for them. So again, you really want to get in touch with Jeb, salesgravy.com. He is amazing. He's written a number of books. Sales EQ is the next one on my list. It's been out for a while, but the objection book, you can't miss with that one. It's a great book, especially if it's an area you struggle in. He breaks it down into easy, doable steps that anybody can do with practice, because we're black belts. We don't get where we want to go without the practice. So today, what are you going to do? What are you going to do to improve your sales ability?
I recommend. Have a tip. What is I have that? A tip. They should go to www.facebook.com/groups/blackbeltselling. Join us. We post awesome content. And again, of course, you get notified the minute these modules go live, or these podcasts go live. So you can keep up with us. You can keep up with our amazing guests. Haven't we gotten some cool guests lately? Come on.
We have.
In the meantime, I do want to encourage you guys to go out there and, you know what, use this as the launching point for this. This is the first day of the rest of your life. And as I was reminded recently, tomorrow is the next first day of the rest of your life. And the day after that is the next first day of the rest of your life. So go out there and make today awesome, because you will never believe how much small steps over time can truly add up. Make it a great week.